Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I want to first thank Glenn Hatchell for sitting in for me last week. My guest today is Dr. Lori Hess, a veterinarian specializing in caring for exotic pets. She's also mere days away from publishing her new book, Unlikely Companions, The Adventures of an Exotic Animal Doctor, a memoir of sorts, with Dr. Hess chronicling the long hours and towering challenges of treating an ever-shifting array of exotic pets at her veterinary center for birds and exotics in New York, one of only seven such facilities in the U.S. and Canada accredited by the American Animal Hospital Association. If Unlikely Companions were just Dr. Hess's account of her fast-paced colorful world, the book would stand as a breezy and engaging read, but there's an additional narrative element that makes Unlikely Companions something of a page-turner. Maybe not whodunit so much as whatdunit. We'll hear more about that mystery, her work, and her new book when I speak with Dr. Lori Hess in just a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Diane Kuhn, one of the organizers of the 7th annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest to be held November 12th at Cote and Chobe, Fort Brooke Park. But right now, let's get to Dr. Hess with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Lori Hess to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Hess.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So I don't think I could calculate the number of people I've interviewed on the show who, while growing up, wanted to be veterinarians and ended up doing something else. You, on the other hand, wanted to be a vet since you were a little kid and traveled that long, arduous path to actually become a vet. So talk a bit about growing up, what animals meant in your family, and what spurred your early fascination with animals that's obviously proved unwavering.
Well, you're absolutely right. Lots of kids go through phases where they want to become a veterinarian. And you are right. I have wanted to be a vet for as long as I can remember. I don't ever remember wanting to be anything other than maybe a professional gymnast. And I grew up in New York City, so I had kind of a crazy life because I had a family that loved animals as much as I do, and they still do. I grew up in an eight-story apartment building in the middle of the Upper East Side in New York City with every kind of imaginable animal you could think of. Dogs and cats, certainly, but birds, fish, guinea pigs, just a whole menagerie of things, different kinds of reptiles. And my family has always been really supportive of my having animals and my being a veterinarian. And my parents will tell me that they knew I definitely was going to be a vet when they took me to Central Park as a little girl. I remember I wasn't even able to walk. My parents were carrying me around. I was a little toddler. And they were holding me up to pet the carriage horses, the Central Park carriage horses. And one of the horses actually bit me in the face. And my parents were mortified, but I just laughed and wanted to continue to pet the horses. So they knew that I had a really special bond with animals then.
No kidding. Now, just to back up for a moment, Dr. Hess, so when you described, as you call it, the menagerie of animals that you grew up with, was that strictly a product of your fascination even then with kind of exotic animals, or were there other family members who were also responsible for the birds, fish, reptiles, and others that you guys shared your home with?
Definitely my whole family. Okay. So I have a brother who recently lost his pet parrot, but he had a parrot for 25 years, an African gray parrot. I grew up with parrots, cats, dogs. My father in particular, who is a pretty high-power workaholic New York City attorney, had two 150-gallon fish tanks in our house, one freshwater and one saltwater, and it was actually his main hobby and, I think, therapy to come home and take care of those fish, including things like stingrays and eels and little mini sharks and things like that in the middle of our apartment.
Wow.
Yes.
So it sounds like you really couldn't actually be a member of the family if you didn't share that passion.
If you didn't like animals, you definitely didn't fit in.
Get out. Get out, they'd say. Yeah. So were there nonetheless any times along the way growing up and then into your high school and then maybe even college years where you considered any sort of alternative to becoming a vet, or was it like, I know this as a kid, but unlike most of the kids like we already discussed, I'm going to go there and nothing's going to stop me?
No, nothing was going to stop me. To be honest, I started working in veterinary hospitals when I was 15. I worked in a local animal hospital a few blocks away from my house for a veterinarian who became my mentor and who I still am very close with today. I worked there every summer. I worked there as a senior in high school. for credit for school. I went on, I went to Yale undergraduate, and I went to Yale specifically knowing that I was going to apply to veterinary school. And ironically, when it came time to apply, I went to the Career Services Department there asking for help, and they basically said to me, "A veterinarian? We've never had anyone come to Yale to be a veterinarian. If you don't want to be a doctor, we don't really know what to do. You're on your own." So, yeah, all the way through, I knew it's what I wanted to do. I wasn't quite sure about the exotics part till later in my career, but I definitely knew that it was going to be veterinary medicine for me.
In fact, I was going to ask you, although obviously I assume the formative years growing up in that family was a big factor, but yeah, I was going to ask, at what point did you start leaning towards a practice that would indeed specialize in caring for birds and exotic animals? I mean, you sort of addressed this in the book that won't be officially out till Tuesday, so maybe you could just give us a sneak preview why in did end up birds and exotic versus, sure, say, cats and dogs or some of the things that most of us might think of when we think of a vet.
Well, I worked in New York City my first year out as a veterinarian doing a rotating internship at a very large animal hospital there, the Animal Medical Center. And just like any other internship, the vets there rotate through cardiology and ophthalmology and surgery and all the different departments. And I spent about 5 weeks in the exotic animals department working with all these various species and birds. And I totally fell in love with them. And most of all, I appreciated the fact that I went to vet school, and in vet school you basically have about a week of training on these animals, and then you're expected to know about everything that walks in the door. And that was kind of daunting, thinking I was going to be out in private practice and have, you know, geckos and birds and rabbits and all kinds of crazy stuff walking in the door, and that I would just have to know how to take care of these animals. So I thought it was really important to go back and learn more, and I went back and did a residency, another additional 2 years, to specialize in the care of these specific various different species.
Let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Lori Hess, a veterinarian specializing in caring for exotic pets, whose new book, Unlikely Companions, The Adventures of an Exotic Animal Doctor, is due out Tuesday. If you'd like to ask Dr. Hess a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So was the idea that, hey, I'm going to lead towards exotics, I'm going to get that training, but was the leaning towards exotic also kind of a parallel with wanting to have your own hospital? Was that sort of always part of the plan once you turned down the lane of exotics?
I actually didn't know I wanted my own hospital till later in life. I had to learn to appreciate the idea that there were so many people out there that had exotic pets, and there was really no place for them to go. I worked for years out of other animal hospitals that catered to dogs and cats and that were also willing to see exotic pets. But exotic pets were kind of a sidelight at these hospitals, so it wasn't until years later I realized that exotics are different, and they need different medical equipment, they need a different environment, and the clientele is a little different, too. So it wasn't until years later that I decided I really wanted to set up a place specifically for exotics that catered just to those animals, and so that these clients that own them, these people that own them, were not just it wasn't like a sidelight for them to going to a dog and cat hospital.
Well, for many people, that's a version of the American dream, I guess. You're opening your own business, ultimately, working at something that you love, but I guess it's also something of a be careful what you pray for situation, in that, as the book makes clear, your work days are incredibly long and grueling, partly because you make yourself available at all times. Maybe you could describe what just any given day, maybe yesterday or any day that comes to mind, is like, what time it starts, what kind of patients you see, what time it ends, and what time it often resumes in some cases when you go back to the hospital after you've ostensibly gone home for the day.
Yes, days are really long, and I think anybody who's in medicine will agree that you never really turn off if you're in any kind of medicine, whether it's veterinary medicine or human medicine or whatever. I think the book gives a really accurate account of what it's like to walk in my shoes as a veterinarian and to be a busy mom. I have two teenage sons. They're a little younger in the book, but the book was written a few years ago. And basically my day started about 5 o'clock in the morning. I get up and I take care of 7 pets at home and my 2 boys, and then I'm out the door. I actually am a type 1 diabetic, so I actually go to the gym every morning to work out. It's an important part of my day. And then I'm in the hospital in the morning seeing patients. I'm fortunate enough now to work with some other veterinarians who I really love, and we all work together from the morning on all day in kind of a marathon, seeing appointments all morning, taking a break, which is really supposed to be time for lunch, but it ends up being surgery and all kinds of medical procedures happen between 1 and 3 o'clock after we finish our appointments in the morning, a bunch of 30-minute appointments on a marathon sort of scale. And then we start again at 3 o'clock, and we finish supposedly at around 6. We aim to be done by 6, but then there are always animals in the hospital that need to be treated and cared for and made sure that they're okay for the evening, and we call our owners back. And then we try to go home, where I go back into mommy mode and help with homework, and I do quite a bit of writing on the side, so I'm often doing writing at night. And then, as you said, the animal hospital employees and I are on call, the other doctors and I are on call, so at nighttime, you can reach us anytime after hours all the way till the next morning through our answering service. So any animals that get sick, whether they're owned by clients of ours or not, you can reach us in the middle of the night, and we certainly try to help you. It's hard for those people because there's no one else for them to reach out to. There aren't other veterinarians in the area who will help them.
Yeah, sort of by design, but the flip side of that is that you are the only game in town, so if somebody does have a problem and it's the middle of the night with their exotic pet, they got to call you because what else can they do?
Exactly.
So let's back up a little bit because, first of all, in describing that day, I think I'm not alone probably amongst those listening thinking, okay, that's pretty tiring just hearing about it. but let's talk a little bit about the 7 pets at home, first of all. Give us the rundown of what pets live with you guys.
Well, you can imagine over the years I've had various different pets. Currently, the menagerie at home consists of 4 cats, a canary, a cockatoo, parrot, lots of birds right now, a caique, which is a medium-sized parrot, and a pionis parrot, also a medium-sized parrot. I have an African gray parrot who lives with me at the animal hospital, and she's in the book as well. She's a special part of our family because she donates blood to animals in need, birds in need at the animal hospital. But over various different times of my life at home, I've had guinea pigs, and we've had, what else have we had, dogs and all kinds of animals. So there's a lot of feeding going on in my house.
For sure.
In the morning.
And then you leave those 7 to walk into your hospital. So maybe just a few random things, like I say, from yesterday or the day before, because
sure.
We got a sense of how kind of long the days are, grueling and sort of really not much let up until the end of the day, and even then not necessarily. But maybe just pick out a few animals that you treated yesterday or recently that might give us a more specific sense of what those days involve.
Well, that's the fun part about being an exotic animal vet. I never know what I'm seeing on any given day. We never know what was walking in the door. And, you know, unfortunately, most of the pets that we see at the animal hospital come in on emergency because most exotic pet owners don't really understand that they should be coming in, as people do with their dogs and cats, for preventative medical care. You know, most of these species that we treat are prey species, and they really hide their illnesses until they're really sick, and that's when owners panic and then call us. So a lot of what we see is emergency care. We saw, for example, yesterday, a bearded dragon lizard who someone had just gotten a few months ago, and unfortunately, they weren't really educated in the proper light and heat and humidity and temperature, all of those factors that are really, really important in keeping a bearded dragon lizard healthy. So this animal was able to survive, but he kind of slowly was getting worse and worse, and by the time he came in, he was really unable to move. So he had something called metabolic bone disease, which is basically when the animal can't make vitamin D in their skin because they don't have ultraviolet light, like we need sunlight to do that as well. And then they can't absorb calcium from their food. So this little animal had reabsorbed all the calcium from his bones, and he wasn't even able to stand up. That was something we saw yesterday. We see a ton of rabbits at the animal hospital. It's really true. They're multiplying like crazy. I've never seen as many rabbits as I see right now in practice. And unfortunately, a lot of them have dental problems. So their teeth grow continuously, unlike ours. And if they're not getting the proper diet, which includes a lot of hay, so they have to chew and grind up their food, chew the hay and wear down their teeth, it's also important for their gastrointestinal systems, then their teeth can overgrow, and they often form these pockets of abscess or infection in their jaw. And unfortunately, these people come in, and by the time they've come in, sometimes there's softball size growths on the side of these animals' faces that are just infections, and then all the teeth have to be pulled out. So we spent a good part of last week doing a lot of rabbit dental surgery, 3 hours at a time, in fact, on 2 different rabbits, and it's quite grueling, but it's really important because that's the only way we're going to make these animals better, by taking out these infected teeth. So as you can see, I have to be a dentist. I have to be a reptile doctor. I have to be an ophthalmologist, a surgeon. I have to wear all the hats, different species.
That brings up a point. I mean, to what extent is there sort of continuing education or training that you undertake just to sort of, because again, it's such a sprawling array of species that you're dealing with, and there must be different breakthroughs or advances in how to treat this animal versus this animal compared to how it was 5 years ago, let's say? Or is there that much change or training that goes on to keep up?
There definitely is. That's a great question. I mean, it's hard enough just to keep up with the anatomy and the diseases of all the different species. But, there is research going on all over the place and all over the world. And the nice thing about being an exotic animal vet is that we're all the exotic animal vets in the world, we're a pretty tight-knit community, and we have a lot of communication. There are a few handful of big associations, Association of Avian Veterinarians, one called the Association of Reptile and Amphibian Veterinarians, and another called the Association of Exotic Mammal Veterinarians. And we all work together. I'm actually a member of all of those, and we have conferences every year that are usually a couple weeks long where we all get together and watch presentations, share ideas, learn about new surgeries, new drugs, new techniques. But it's quite challenging. You have to really do a lot of reading and stay up to date.
Yeah, and on a parallel point, it's clear from the book and even a couple of the examples that you gave with the bearded dragon lizard and even the rabbits, I guess it might depend partly on where a certain animal came from and how common it is. But it seems like, again, from the book and maybe suggested possibly from what you described here about the rabbit and the bearded dragon lizard, that sometimes the folks that get those animals aren't necessarily all that educated or at least completely, maybe I should say, educated in how to care for those animals. So you would hope that somebody that got a rabbit would know about the teeth and make sure that they are getting hay or things that are going to keep them chewing and therefore grinding and keeping the teeth from growing longer. But perhaps less common would be a bearded dragon lizard. And if you don't know somehow, even though you ended up with a bearded dragon lizard in your home, about the ultraviolet light and what the upshot of not getting that kind of light would be, you're looking at some serious problems.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of these animals are amazingly interesting pets. They're great to look at. Parrots are colorful. They talk. Lizards are incredible to watch. I mean, some of the reptiles are really amazing to watch. Cute and cuddly guinea pigs, rabbits, all these different species. And unfortunately, many people on a whim just go out and get these animals. They adopt them. They purchase them without really learning about what these animals need. And one of the things that I hope that my book accomplishes is not only to share with you some of the fun and exciting and heartwarming stories and experiences I've had with the owners of these pets, but also to let people know that these animals really do need medical care, that there are places like my animal hospital and veterinarians like me who are out there trying to educate people about the need for proper care to maintain the health and welfare of these pets so that, you know, owners can enjoy them, but the animals can feel good and feel happy and have good quality of life. So I think it's really important to think a lot and really consider what it means to have an exotic pet in terms of the long-term commitment. Many of them live dozens and dozens of years. And I'm hoping, again, in my book, Unlikely Companions, you see the kind of bonds that they make, but also that these exotic pets really, really do need proper care and some planning.
It's an interesting point because I just get the sense, and you kind of alluded to it already here, that for people who do end up with exotic pets, maybe it's some exception depending on the pet in question, but just generally maybe they don't think in terms of preventative care the way we would take a cat or a dog in to have a regular checkup and see what's going on. So like you say, if you aren't tending to do that, then you're only going to see you or your colleagues when there's a problem, which obviously is late, too late in some cases.
Exactly. Well, we try to train people. Unfortunately, you know, they come in the first time with their pets, often on an emergency basis when the animals are really ill. But then when we explain to them, you know, if they come in regularly, once a year even, we can prevent a lot of the problems that ultimately can either lead to the death of the pet or certainly more expense in caring for the pet. And if we just stay ahead of it, just like we do with our own health, you know, go to the doctor or go to the dentist preventatively, you can prevent those diseases from happening and live a much better quality life. Same thing for animals.
For sure. Do you find that a lot of times the first time that you see a patient, meaning the animal, not necessarily the human, but maybe both in some cases, that's really the first opportunity that they've had to learn about the scope, really, of caring for that particular animal?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I think that the first visit, that people have with us and their pets is about educating them about how to properly feed, house, maintain their animals, just the basics. Even if they think their animals are healthy and need to come in just for, say, a nail trim, we end up really educating them about things that they might be doing better, that maybe they got the animal at a pet store or went online to read about its care. And unfortunately, a lot of the information online and even in some of the even best pet stores is outdated. So it's our job to really educate them. And that's the goal that I have at the Animal Hospital, that I hope, if nothing else, you know, people come in and they get an education from us, and that it's reflected in how they care for their animal in the future.
And what you said about where they might get their animals kind of dovetails with the question I had, which is that when it comes to exotic animals, there seems to be and have been for some time kind of a flourishing black market. When is the source of an animal your business, or do you feel like it never is? In other words, some of these operations make puppy mills look like grand operations by comparison. So does that ever figure into, especially your first examination of an animal, like where did it come from, especially depending on maybe why they're in there, what the illness or issue is? But are those part of the conversation you sometimes have depending on the animal?
I have had to have those conversations, fortunately, only a couple times in my life. I don't see primates in my hospital generally. I don't see venomous snakes, so I don't think they make good pets, and I avoid dealing with those situations at all costs. I don't really want to put anyone here at risk. There have been a couple of occasions in my career where people have brought in animals that I know are severely endangered. I can recall years and years ago when I worked in New York City, a very nice man who thought he was doing something good brought in 7 tortoises. They were a species of tortoise at the time that actually had just been featured on the cover of National Geographic that month as being severely endangered. And he had 7 of them, and he told me he was transporting them from one location to another to a breeding facility. He needed health certificates on them, so he needed a veterinarian to sign off on them. And he couldn't really produce any documentation for me to show me he had them in this breeding program legally as part of a zoo that he think he was working with. So unfortunately, I had to report him. And I don't think, you know, in that situation, I thought he really was meaning to do well. But there are permits and regulations, and certainly with certain species of animals, you know, you have to follow the rules. It depends on your locale, and if you're going to have a pet that's an unusual kind of exotic pet, you really do need to check in your area to make sure that if they're legal. I mean, there are some animals like ferrets, for example, that are illegal in New York City and illegal in California, yet plenty of people have them there. And honestly, some of these regulations don't make sense to me because I see lots of ferrets, and while they're safe 40 miles outside New York City, they're not safe in New York City according to the laws here in New York, ferrets, that is. Sometimes it doesn't always make sense, but certainly for endangered species, dangerous species that could harm people, I do feel that I do have to say something. But as I said, fortunately, I haven't had that come up that often.
And it sounds like when it has, tended to be kind of an innocent mistake or violation, like the guy with the tortoises, for example.
It has been, yeah.
Yeah. So now, speaking of that, let's talk a little bit more about some of the animals you treat or could treat. I think I saw somewhere that you treat hedgehogs. Now, how often do you actually see a hedgehog in your practice?
Very often, in fact.
Really?
They're pretty
yeah.
popular pets, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And what kind of pets do they make?
They're fun. They're shy.
Mm-hmm.
They do require quite a bit of handling because, as you can imagine, they're known for their ability to ball up into a little tight ball with little prickly spurs all over.
Yeah.
And while that may not sound like the most fun pet in the world, if you're willing to spend some time with a hedgehog, they get really, they're really adorable. They are socialized. They'll come out. They'll walk around. They'll recognize their owners. They're really curious little creatures. They're really adorable. But if you don't have time for them, again, that's not the pet for you. So that's a great example of a pet that, you know, you really need to learn about what they're like. They're also nocturnal, so they like to be up in the evening. And if you go to sleep early and you want to interact with your pet, again, hedgehog isn't right for you. But they can make terrific pets for the right people in the right circumstances.
So, Dr. Hess, that makes me wonder if, by the way, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Lori Hess, a veterinarian specializing in caring for exotic pets. Her new book coming out Tuesday is Unlikely Companions, The Adventures of an Exotic Animal Doctor. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813 813- 833-0885. So, Dr. Hess, so with people that you have seen over the years in your practice, and as we all experience with whatever kind of animals we have, they at a certain point do pass away. So are there times where people will say to you, hey, Dr. Hess, I think I'm ready now to have a new animal enter my life and my family. I'm thinking about this, this, and this. Or do they kind of seek your counsel? Like, for example, you know, I don't know how, if someone would say, I'm thinking about a hedgehog, or I'm thinking about such and such. Or do you, knowing their history even, do you kind of say, hey, you know, this might be a good fit for your leanings, your lifestyle, or what the kind of animal you had previously?
Yes, I frequently get people who really just want to call and talk and learn more about a particular kind of pet. In fact, I remember recently I had a young girl, probably about 11 or 12 years old, come in with her mom to the animal hospital. They made a specific appointment, not with a pet, but just to sit down and talk about what kind of pet they wanted. And this little girl was fascinated by sugar gliders. Sugar gliders are these little, they look like flying squirrels, but they're actually in the marsupial or kangaroo family. And they are adorable little animals. In fact, there's a whole long story about the sugar glider mysteries that I dealt with in my practice. It's in my book. But they came in just really being fascinated by sugar gliders. And as we sat and had our visit, the little girl realized there's a lot of care that goes into a sugar glider, and she really didn't have the time for a sugar glider. So by the end of the conversation, she had decided that actually what she wanted and what was a better pet for her was a cockatiel. So she went out and got a cockatiel, and it was a great match, and the animal's doing great. The little girl's very happy, and the mom's really happy. And I'm glad, because she would have gotten the wrong pet, and unfortunately, too many people do that, and they end up being disappointed or frustrated with the animal that they get. And for many birds, that means they ultimately end up being dumped in shelters, and everyone's unhappy. The bird has no home, and the people are disappointed. So if more people would learn about the animals and certainly seek out some expert advice, whether it's from a veterinarian who knows about exotic pets or a breeder, I think the matches that we make between pets and people would be much better in the end.
Yeah, well, that's great that they had access to you and you had the time, for example, to have that conversation and for that little girl to decide, hey, you know what, a sugar glider is not for me. So along those lines, so we sort of have just a few minutes left here, Dr. Hess. So the book does offer this element of kind of a mystery or maybe even a thriller that's kind of laced along just the memoir that you offer about the practice and your family and other things as well. So obviously we don't want to spoil that mystery, but do you feel like sort of outlining the basics of the sugar glider story that is in Unlikely Companions?
Sure. So I do see quite a few sugar gliders. They were a fad pet for a while. A lot of them came in all at one time, and there's one company that supplies most of the sugar gliders in the country. And for a period of time a few years ago, we saw a bunch of them come in into my practice and to some other practices in my area. And they had sort of a mysterious illness. And no matter what we did, no matter what tests we did and what medications we tried, we couldn't make them better. And we were losing them, and it was very frustrating. And I was working with the company to try to figure this out. They were very concerned. And in my book, we talk about what happened. And basically, with the help of some colleagues in the area, we put our heads together, the other exotic animal vets and I, and we managed to figure out what the situation was. It was not at all what we expected to begin with, and we solved the mystery of the 6 sugar gliders. So it was a long and challenging set of cases in my practice, something that I will always remember and something that I wanted to share with everyone. So if you love sugar gliders, if you like good mysteries, if you love pets, it's all in there in the book.
It really does give a whole other narrative drive to Unlikely Companions, and it is pretty fascinating. And then you're hooked and say, okay, what is going on with the sugar gliders? I must know. So pretty soon it is a page-turner because you really want to get to the bottom of it, just like you and your colleagues did. And plus, I was struck along those lines that, with one obvious exception, I guess, how collaborative you and the other veterinarians were bedeviled by this mystery and this sort of whole online path to post things and seek help and input and people making calls and really trying to help each other across state and states ultimately. I thought that was really a nice thing to see, that there was that much teamwork kind of.
Yeah, exotic animal vets, as I was saying, we are really a close-knit team. Most people go into exotic pet medicine, veterinary medicine, because they love the animals. And that certainly, as you can see, as I was describing before from my childhood, I did this because I truly love the animals. I love all the species that I treat. People ask me often, you know, what's my favorite species? And I really can't even say. I mean, I really do enjoy my work. And I love helping people. So unfortunately, you hear people say, oh, you know, vets become vets because they don't want to deal with people. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. I love the people who own these animals. For the most part, these are wonderful, caring people. And I've built wonderful relationships with these owners and their pets, as you can see in the book. And I really wanted to share the incredible bonds that people can share with their animals, their exotic pets, and that I've shared with their families and their pets. And the book is really a series of stories that make you feel good. They're heartwarming. They're happy. They're silly. They're funny. Sometimes a little unbelievable. I think the book will make you feel good. If you've ever had a pet, you will definitely relate to a story in the book.
Yeah, and it really, the book really is about the people, and you really get sort of a sense of people, especially some that are kind of sheepish even about their pets, or they're in marriages where the people don't understand their connection or affection for a certain pet, or there's a financial implication. So, yeah, you really, there's a lot of people stories as much as there's exotic pet stories to unlikely companions.
Absolutely. There's something in there for everyone.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't ask you what your favorite species was. I mean, if I had to guess, though, based on the book and who you have at home, you're kind of ultimately a bird person, don't you think, Dr. Haas?
I love birds. I won't lie. I am a bird specialist. I find them completely fascinating. Their anatomies, their diseases, their personalities, they're very, very different from other animals. And people do get very close to their birds because many, many birds live, you know, bigger birds in particular live into their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and longer. I have a 20-year-old parrot at home right now who, you know, he's been part of my life for a long, long time. So I do love birds, and I think they're fascinating and really smart, and they really need to be appreciated. But I love all species in general.
Sure. And since we're talking about a practice that inherently treats unusual or, again, obviously exotic animals, I guess I can't let you go without asking, kind of over the years of your career, what's the most unusual animal that you have treated?
Oh, I get asked that a lot.
Yeah, sure.
I think monkeys are probably the most unusual. As I said, I don't think monkeys make pets, good pets in people's homes. People do have them. Unfortunately, they are often thought of as child substitutes. And unfortunately, they do carry all the same diseases we can get and that as children we're vaccinated for. I have treated a few monkeys, and I've had some very strange experiences with them. I also...
Can you say what a strange experience might be?
Yeah,
or,
in a nutshell?
Yeah.
I was 2 weeks out of school, working in New York City, working in the largest animal hospital in the United States at that time, dealing with 100 animals in the hospital, and anything that walked in the store, in the door, in the middle of the night in New York City. And I had a gentleman come in with a monkey in a bag, a little teeny monkey in a gym bag, and a large cat. And the long and short of it is, the monkey was in a coma, it had had a seizure. Its arm was bitten off by the cat, who was freaked out by the seizuring monkey, and he wanted me to take the monkey's arm out of the cat and put it back on to the monkey.
Oh, my goodness.
And being a veterinarian for 2 weeks, certainly I think even now, veterinarian 20-plus years later, I wasn't prepared for this scenario. I managed to take care of the monkey's arm. The little monkey's arm was passing through the cat like a chicken bone. It was not to be saved. The cat did fine. Unfortunately, the monkey had a very serious illness and passed away. It was seizuring. But it was a pretty unexpected and kind of incredible story for me in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning in New York City, 2 weeks out of vet school.
Well, I have to say, Dr. Haas, when someone asks you, hey, give me an unusual story of treating an animal, you deliver big time. So that's really great. So we have reached about the end of our time here, Dr. Haas. We've been speaking with Dr. Lori Haas. Her book that's due out Tuesday, although it can, be pre-ordered now, is Unlikely Companions, The Adventures of an Exotic Animal Doctor, and that's going to be available anywhere that you get books typically. There's two websites I want to let you know about. The hospital that she runs, the website for that is avianexoticsvet.com. And then separately, Dr. Haas has a website, Lori, L-A-U-R-I-E, HaasDVM.com. So, Dr. Haas, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Great, thanks. In a few moments, I'll speak with Diane Kuhn about the Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up at Okeechobee Fort Brooke Park in just over 2 weeks. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. With Veg Fest on the horizon, I thought we'd hear this piece from Mike Kaplan. This is Ducks and Vegetarians from Mike Kaplan in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I was in a Chinese restaurant recently, and I was thinking about how a small duck is called a duckling. And I canceled my order of dumplings. Because I am a vegetarian, so. Do we have any other vegetarians here? That is a little better than I got at the steakhouse. Great. I did comedy in a steakhouse. Honestly, I was like, hey, are there any vegetarians here? Finally, one guy in the back was like, this is a steakhouse. So I moved on. I was like, okay, any Jews here? This is a steakhouse. We eat Jews here. So I left. Like, people hear that, they assume I'm always into other kinds of activism. They're like, oh, you're a vegetarian. Do you care about the environment? No. I eat the environment. That's what we do. It's made of vegetables. But I do eat some weird things, like pickle sandwiches, like a nice dill pickle on sourdough bread, or a sour pickle on dildo bread. And that's just a word one, everybody. Good work. Good work. I think words are important. They're really all that separate us from the mimes, you know? So. Here's another word, pescatarian. You know that one? That means my mom, she says she's a vegetarian, but she's really a pescatarian, which means she eats fish in addition to lying about being a vegetarian. That's what she does. She actually says, she's like, I'll become a vegetarian when fish becomes a vegetable, which is sadly not the way evolution is heading, so. Unless people are getting dumber and animals are reverting back into plants, which would be all right, but.
That was Mike Kaplan with a piece called Ducks and Vegetarians, taken from his CD, Vegan Mind Meld. Now, on a very related note, let's move to my brief conversation with Diane Kuhn, one of the organizers of the 7th Annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest, happening November 12th at Cotonchobee, Fort Brooke Park. Let's welcome Diane Kuhn to Talking Animals. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
You bet. So let's start at the remedial level. What is the Tampa Bay Veg Fest?
Tampa Bay Veg Fest, well, we're in our 7th year. We have been bringing this event to the Tampa Bay area to promote a vegetarian, vegan lifestyle. We're happy to bring this to the area, and we've been having great success. The crowds are getting bigger every year.
That's great. And I think it was probably within the 3rd or 4th year or thereabouts, but early on, Tampa Bay Veg Fest received some national attention as one of the best veg fests in the country, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we did. It was the Green Planet. They did a survey, and yes, we were voted in the top 10. Very exciting for us because we were relatively new at that time.
Yeah.
Still kind of just beginning. So that was a really great opportunity for us to get the word out and let people know about it. It's actually, Florida now is I don't know, we've got about, I'm going to say, guess around 8-7 veg fests in the whole state now. So it's really becoming more and more popular, this movement of these vegetarian vegan festivals.
Yeah, but how many are in the top 10 nationally?
I know. Yeah. I know. Well, we're very pleased about that, and we strive to attain that level every year, and I think this year everyone will be very impressed with what we're doing, and I'm happy to say that we have more food vendors than we've had any other year. We have over 30 food vendors, and
wow.
They will all be having vegan food and drink. Plus, that's not to mention all the free, all the food samples we'll be having. We have organizations, different, like for instance, IKEA is coming this year, and they will be bringing their veggie balls that they sell at the store. They'll be giving out free samples.
You know, what's interesting about that, just as a side note, Diane, is, that is an enormous number of food vendors, and
yes.
Some people who've organized large events on that scale sometimes encounter a point at which if there's a certain number of food vendors, and again, especially if it goes beyond a certain number, the other food vendors think, well, I don't know how successful I'm going to be because there's, in other words, too much competition for that many food vendors to do well at that event or that festival. I guess you don't encounter that because it sounds like a record number of...
Yeah, and the thing about it is most of our food vendors are our return vendors, which I find that's interesting. So I'm guessing that they're all doing quite well. And actually this year we have a lot of starter businesses, new new businesses that are out there promoting their new, like new, we have a promoter of a vegan cashew nut cheese that she's making. So there's a lot of new vendors too, plus our old ones that have been coming back yearly.
Well, this is great. So let's, I'm going to come back to a couple other things, but let's make sure we hit all the basics first.
Sure.
So give us the when, where, and those kinds of things for the Veg
Well,
Fest.
I can start out with letting you know about our speakers. And the main thing I need to let everybody know about that is that the speakers are in the Tampa History Center on the first floor. They are not in the actual park itself. A lot of times people ask us about that. We will have 5 speakers starting at 10 in the morning, and our last one is at 3 in the afternoon. And you can actually get on the website to find out who our speakers will be. But we do have that going on. We also have the cooking demos, which is in the park itself, and we're going to have 5 cooking demos this year also, which is the largest cooking demo we've ever had. We have a Veggie Kids Zone, which will be pretty great this year. We have a puppet show for the kids. We have lots of entertaining and interactive activities for the children. We have live music. We have, of course, the food court with lots of food. And something we're really proud of this year is we're going to have a raffle, which is probably going to be our biggest and best raffle we've ever had. We have great items on our raffle booth this year, so we hope everybody will stop by. And all the proceeds of the raffle will go to our animal rescues and sanctuaries that are going to be at the festival that day.
Cool. So can you give us a sneak preview of what sort of hotshot items the raffle will offer this year?
I can. One of them we got at the last minute is a 2-night stay at the Marriott Waterside there right next to the Veg Fest.
Nice.
Yeah, and Chipotle gave us a box, a burrito box for 50 burritos. So if you're planning a party and you need to...
Wow, if you need a lot of burritos, you know where to go.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have just all sorts of gift certificates and books and, just a wide range of different items.
Cool. Well, this sounds great, and it sounds like there's a lot of elements that people have grown to love over the previous 6 years, and yet some new wrinkles that you're offering as well. So, Dan, let's give us the website, and, I know there's a Facebook page as well, just so people can find out more. And
Sure. If you get onto our website, TampaBayVegFest.org, you can get all the information there. We have our Facebook page link on there also. It gives you everything you'll need to know as far as what time the speakers are, what time the cooking demos are, what time the children's activities are, our music schedule. Everything's on the website. So I don't think if you can navigate to there, you'll find out. Or you can give us a call if you have any questions. It's 727-641-8268.
Cool. Great. And again, you guys are on Facebook, so you can just go on to Facebook and just search for Tampa Bay Veg Fest, and there's a new post, it seems like, very frequently for updates about vendors and other things going on, exhibitors, et cetera. So there's plenty of information if you're looking to seek it and trying to plan your day. Because, again, it goes from 10 a.m. to, is it 5 or is it?
Yeah, 5 p.m.
Right. So, again, that's many things that's great about an event running that long is that for a lot of people, if they've got kids and stuff, there's games and stuff on Saturday, whatever. But, I mean, in that window, no matter what you've got going or what your commitments already are, you can usually swing by and there's still great stuff to be had, great stuff to be consumed. And again, those 30 food vendors, I mean, that sounds pretty sprawling, but we don't want to step on their business. But as you kind of alluded to briefly, there also often at least are samples of things that just other exhibitors or other booths are offering. And so there's really a lot of cool things. And I think it's safe to say just kind of more philosophically that while it might sound initially like this is aiming for people who are vegetarian and vegan, and on some level, of course, it is, but it does seem like it's also intended to reach out to people who maybe aren't or just making steps in those directions, and that it's a great way to find out more information. It's a great way to try things where you think, I just don't know if that kind of food's for me. And, you know, with all those food vendors and some of the samples and stuff, it's a really wonderful way to kind of really get your feet more wet if you're just sort of, like I say, kind of heading down that direction initially. So.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Cool, Diane. Well, thanks so much. So we'll look forward to that. It's again November 12th, Okeechobee Fort Brooke Park, and the website is TampaBayVegFest.org. And again, you can just search for that on Facebook if you want to go that route as well. So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to the
Welcome.
Veg Fest.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the noon hour, it constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, we'll do a few little animal news and announcement items, including an event happening this Saturday at Ferg's. That's Ferg's Live, Channel Side. It's their Strut, Wag, and Rock. And among those being featured there will be Dogma, Pet Rescue, Second Chance Boxer Rescue, and Four Lucky Dog Rescue, all participating. And this thing seems to run most of the day up through, I think, 8 o'clock at night. So you find out more, and you can register if you want to get involved with Strut, Wag, Rock. But either way, you can go to strutwagrock.org. And some folks, there'll be costume contests and other people offering all kinds of treats and things. So that out this Saturday at Ferg's. Also, looking not too far down the road, Stride for Strays is coming up November 6th from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Perry Harvey Park on Orange Street in Tampa. That's the Animal Coalition of Tampa's annual event there, where you can walk your dogs, but there's all kinds of other activities too, and lots of vendors and music and all kinds of great contests. So go to actampa.org, or I think strideforstrays.org has its own dedicated website. And looking further ahead towards the latter part of November, Florida Voices for Animals will host Tampa Bay's 11th annual Thanks Vegan Feast on, appropriately enough, Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa, located in Temple Terrace. So, ideally, the idea is to bring a vegan dish that could feed 8 or more people, but there's various ways that you can arrange going to that. So, for more information, go to thanksvegan.com, or you can just email thanksvegan@gmail.com. And I think that will do it for today's edition of Animal News and Announcements. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. This is a rearranged rendition of a song often played on Talking Animals, including the last 2 weeks in a row by two different hosts. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, cause I like birds. If you're small and on the search, I've got a feeder for you to perch on. I don't care for walking around town, crazy auto car gonna pull me down. Look at all the people like cows in a herd. Well, I like birds.
If people have guesses, we'll take those probably off air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, November 2nd, with another edition of the show. Meanwhile, please visit talkinganimals.net, where you can find audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. And follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Well, let's see what happens. Or maybe we'll try to put some... Hi, you're on Talking Animals live on the air. Can you name that animal tune?
Bird.
What's that?
Was it bird?
Was it just birds? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, bird.
We need a little bit more than that. That's one of the key words, certainly.
I like birds.
There you go. Okay, cool. What is your first name?
Melissa,
okay, you have one that is the eels with a different version of I Like Birds. So I'm going to put you on hold and we'll get your information and send you a t-shirt. Thanks. Okay. Stand by. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.